Morning. We're here today on a rules petition 1008 in the matter of the petition to establish a right to counsel in civil cases. This is an amendment to SCR 11.02 paren 2 paren. And we have an order of presentations because people have to leave the courtroom to make other engagements. So ordinarily we would have Mr. Ebbett, Executive Director of Legal Action of Wisconsin, appear first and present this, but he has asked that we defer his presentation until after several other people speak so that they can keep their schedules, and I will adhere to that as we agreed. Our first speaker today is Judge David W. Keck, Winnebago County Court Commissioner. We have a number of speakers. My list shows 27, but I was advised, I think, yesterday that there may be as many as 30. If there's anyone whose name is not on the list, would you please talk with the Marshal, Tina Nodoff, and get your name on the list. Because there's this large number, we will limit everyone to no longer than 8 minutes, and we hope a shorter time. And if your point has already been made by someone, if you would please just say, I agree with the point that, and we'll note that. That would be very helpful for emphasizing all the issues that we have before us. And we haven't started your time, sir, so now.
Thank you. I will be brief. I am Dave Keck. I'm a court commissioner in Winnebago County. I have been for 5 years now, and I'm here to talk about the experience of the unrepresented, both in court as well as in the legal process. I'm here to talk about this because I think in the message that I wanted to bring down here this morning is that I think as attorneys, I think we've all forgotten at times the complexity of legal issues that are in front of us, and I think that that's really the message that I want to leave the court with here this morning. As a family court commissioner, I enter into custody, placement, and child support orders in both divorces and paternities. I enforce those orders as well. I also hear all the small claims cases in our county, and I handle all of the harassment and domestic abuse injunctions. I don't have any statistics for the court this morning as to the percentage of the litigants in front of me who are unrepresented, but I can say to the court that it's fair to say that of all of the unrepresented who come through our system in our county, I see a majority of those people. I'm also here as co-founder and supervising attorney of the Winnebago County Free Legal Assistance Clinic, which is in November will be celebrating its third year of operation. We meet three times a month in Neenah, Menasha, and Oshkosh, and each night we have about 40 clients who come through our clinic, and they meet with an attorney for free. And so I see at least 100 unrepresented people a month in our county as the supervising attorney for the legal assistance clinic.
And is this attorneys provided by the local bar association?
They're all volunteer attorneys. We have probably between 3 and 7 attorneys at each clinic. We have about 5 volunteers from the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh who also staff the clinic. My role, since I am a judicial officer, I'm not allowed to give any legal advice or help anyone with the law. So my role at the clinic is essentially as a bailiff. I greet the people when they come in. I seat the people. I take them in to be screened. And then from there, I take them to meet with an attorney, depending on what type of question they have. And that will become important here. There's an important point I want to make.
This is unbundled legal services. That is, they answer that particular question but don't necessarily take the case.
Exactly. We have everyone sign a waiver pursuant to the Supreme Court rule that they understand that the representation is limited to the time that they're speaking. Once the meeting ends at the clinic, then the representation is done. We make them sign a release to that effect. My observations, as both as a court commissioner seeing unrepresented litigants as well as a supervising attorney from the Legal Assistance Clinic, is that the, I guess as court commissioner, I see that the, what happens is the court is often placed in a position of playing referee in a game where one team doesn't even know what the rules are. And I see that on a, really on a daily basis. I do contested hearings all day, and as I said, most of the people are, a majority are unrepresented. And I'm not here to complain about how difficult that is for me, but I'm here just to make the point that that's, that I see it injustice that's a potential there whenever there's someone there without an attorney, doesn't even know, as I said, what the rules of the game are, and I'm supposed to call balls and strikes there. Litigants come to court expecting a fair process that's going to decide their dispute in a legal manner. Unrepresented litigants come to court expecting the court will try their case or assist their defense for them. And that's, I think, where our, the system that we have currently does tend to let litigants down. My experience from the Legal Assistance Clinic is that when I take a file and bring it to an attorney who is at the clinic volunteering their time, these are some of the best attorneys in our county. They're some of the most experienced attorneys. And I will bring them a file, and they will be reluctant to talk to the person because that's an area of law they're not familiar with. So we try to have at least two attorneys at every clinic who are familiar with family law, because an attorney who is not familiar with family law won't even want to give any kind of advice or even talk about that.
Would you say most of the people who come to the clinic are family law or small claims, well, or landlord-tenant or...
Initially, they were probably 60 or 70% were family. Now it's about, in the last 2 years, there have been a lot more people who have come with financial issues, either foreclosure, they have credit card issues, bankruptcy questions. And again, unless an attorney knows bankruptcy law, they won't want to even give any advice. Clients come hoping that an attorney will help them, but because of the complexity of the specific areas of the law, many attorneys are rightfully declining to offer any assistance. They won't even want to talk briefly or even talk at all about that. And my point here is that if experienced attorneys don't feel they're competent to answer questions about a case, especially a family law case, what chance does an untrained, uninitiated person have litigating their case if an experienced attorney doesn't even want to talk about it? I think as attorneys, we've all had the experience of stepping out into a new area of law. When we're new, either new to a legal office or moved to a different office or asked to take on a different kind of case than we've done, I think we've all had the experience of looking at what we're expected to do and saying, what does this form mean? Where do I file it? What does the statute mean? How do we do this? What does all of this do? And I think it takes every attorney weeks or even months of practice and going back to the office and talking to other attorneys about exactly how do I do this, what did I miss, what should I be doing, how should I be doing this. The unrepresented don't have that opportunity. By the time they're in the courtroom and the time they've made the mistake, forgot to ask the question, didn't prepare, they missed something, the hearing is almost over and they've already lost before they've even had a chance to practice or even know that they've lost. Even the simplest legal issues are overwhelmingly complex to the uninitiated. That's been my experience throughout the last few years. I think we all have to also acknowledge here that there's always going to be limitations to self-representation. We all have the right to represent ourselves, and we know about what's said about somebody who represents themselves. But when a party voluntarily chooses to proceed without counsel, that's the risk that they may not understand, but they do that, and we all understand what that risk is, and that's inherent in our system, and everyone has the right to do that. But where a party's not voluntarily involved in a legal dispute, those problems are exacerbated because they're not there to practice law, they're not there to learn the law. They have a real problem that really affects their lives. Whether it's financial, whether it's the loss of their home, whether it's the loss of their children, they're not asking to be in court, they're not asking to play attorney, but they're suddenly faced with an issue that
Mr.
Yes.
Mr. Kick, I didn't check this before I came in, but should the court adopt this resolution or something similar to it, would it authorize commissioners to appoint counsel? Because there's a statute that gives the commissioners a power, and they tend to say, or some of them say, similar powers to the judge. So I can look it up, but I wondered if
I haven't researched that exact issue myself, but I don't see that as a real impediment. One of the things that the commissioners could do, and I think I can speak for myself and say I'd be willing to do that, is certainly screen the cases. We've proposed, John Ebbett and I have proposed, and we have something in the works where our legal assistance clinic would actually have attorneys do some of that pre-screening. In other words, something in the, akin to a no-merit brief, where the attorney would actually meet with a client and would sign something saying, this is the type of case, this is a person who actually could benefit from having an attorney appointed for them. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of a detail that could be worked out, but I think court commissioners at least could do a screening process if they weren't mm-hmm. actually doing the appointment. In our county, we do, as court commissioners, we do dean appointments in criminal cases, so I don't right. see that as really a problem. Self-help centers, as I have said, and pro se forms are two major steps that have been done in the last few years, and they're very important steps to helping pro se litigants. And
I was going to ask you about the pro se forms. And the self-help clinics can range in being full-time and fully staffed with lawyers, et cetera, to being your legal assistance clinic.
As I said, we help about 40 people a night, so over probably 120 a month come to our clinic. Lots of them just receive forms. Sometimes they receive help in filling out forms. One of the biggest problems is which form do I actually use, and the clerks of our court are not allowed to give that advice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The clinic that we do give that advice, those are a tremendous help, especially with starting and initiating an action, starting a divorce, filing a motion to modify child support, a motion to enforce a support order. Those have been very helpful for that reason. But also helpful in lots of times because an attorney can sit down and tell someone how to proceed. But
Commissioner, 8 minutes goes by quickly when you're having fun. And your red light is on. So
okay.
If you wish to summarize in one sentence or two.
Yes.
That's fine, and then I'll
thank
ask you to
thank
stop.
Thank you for your time. I just wanted to say that the self-help clinics are not enough. It's pretty much, I guess, like going to a medical clinic and being told you have a serious medical condition, you need to have your appendix removed, and then going home and trying to figure out how to remove your appendix. More accurate than that is being told at a clinic that you have some condition, the doctor can treat that, and then going home and remembering something the doctor told you, but not really remembering the specifics and not really knowing where to go. Self-help clinics and pro se forms are a tremendous step, but they're simply not enough.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for coming in and down, and safe travels home.
Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Mary Trigiano, Milwaukee County Circuit Court.
Justice Abrahamson, Justices, I want to thank each of you first for your willingness to hear this petition here today. I am in my seventh year on the bench in Milwaukee County. Before becoming a judge, I spent 10 years at Legal Action, managing the Milwaukee office and running the Volunteer Lawyers Project. Before that, I spent 6 years in private practice accepting pro bono civil legal services cases when I could. In the past 7 years, I have had lawyers representing litigants in the vast majority of the cases I have presided over. I spent 5 years at Children's Court, cloaked in the inherent authority to appoint counsel when necessary for parents in neglect proceedings under Joni B. versus State of Wisconsin. I also have had many pro se litigants appear in front of me. I am here today to support the court's expansion of our inherent authority to appoint counsel to cases where basic human needs are at stake, and I do so for 3 reasons. First, lawyers make a difference, They make a difference by helping to ensure a fair outcome in our cases. Second, to underscore this court's leadership in this endeavor. And third, to emphasize that no one has to start from scratch. Nationally, there are programs where counsel are appointed in civil legal cases, and locally as well. So first, lawyers and fairness. Judges want more than anything to make sure the right decisions. They want to make sure that all the persons who come before them are treated fairly. And they truly want to run efficient courts. To make fair decisions, courts need the parties to find and present controlling legal principles, uncover and present all relevant facts, follow complex rules of evidence, and present claims in a cogent and efficient manner. It is self-evident to judges, practicing attorneys, and the community that indigent persons without counsel cannot perform these tasks in most cases. These tasks almost always require the expertise of lawyers. When these tasks are not done or not done by lawyers, judges struggle to make those good decisions. Good case management becomes almost impossible, and fairness is compromised. Pro se litigants are a significant and growing burden on a judicial system. Many of us are ill-equipped to deal with them. I am sure you will hear many examples of cases where pro se litigants lacked the knowledge and expertise to effectively present their case and then suffered the consequences. I will not repeat these here. Suffice it to say that empirical studies demonstrate that pro se litigants receive less favorable outcomes, and they receive less favorable outcomes much more often than litigants who have a lawyer. Because the disparity in outcomes is so great, the inescapable conclusion of some of these studies is that many pro se litigants are losing cases they should win. Most disturbing, these disparate outcomes occur in cases where basic necessities of life, such as the ability to raise one's children, to find shelter, to obtain food and health care, and to be free from violence, are at stake. This brings me to my second point, this court's leadership. Joni B. was powerful medicine, but it needs to be reinforced and expanded. It is essential that this court reaffirm and extend those principles to cases where basic human needs are at stake, not just cases involving child neglect. And judges need to hear from the state's highest court that the principles of Joni B. can, do, and should apply in other cases where a basic human need is at stake. As Stephen Sachs indicated in his keynote address seeking a right to appointed counsel in civil cases in Maryland, fairness is not a function of the legal proceedings or the label on the proceedings. A proceeding is either fair or it is not. We know that judges want to ensure fairness in the cases over which they preside. Many have told me that they are also mindful of limitations in funding for appointed counsel. Judges, in my opinion, without a doubt, want to be good stewards of the public resources that have been conferred on us. But any consideration of the cost of appointing counsel must also take into cost the significant cost to the judicial system where litigants are forced to proceed without counsel. These costs include, for example, the burden faced by judges to make correct rulings when the record is incomplete, the extra time required of judges and judicial staff to guide pro se litigants through court proceedings, and the burden of litigating cases that both parties likely would have settled. Equally important, these costs also include the erosion of public confidence in the judicial system when disparate outcomes for pro se indigent litigants create an appearance that the judicial system is not fair to them. Besides the cost to the judicial system, there are immense societal costs when litigants or other affected persons are unjustly deprived of basic human needs because they didn't have a lawyer. The ultimate consequences of people deprived of basic human needs reside in systems other than our legal system. They reside in poor school performance and a burdened school system, unemployment and underemployment, substantial health care costs, and losses of food, shelter, and health care. Families headed by women, the elderly, children, and families of color suffer these consequences disproportionately. The Court understood all of this when it stated in Joni B., in some cases, and I quote, the state's pecuniary interest will not outweigh the interest shared by the state and the parent in a just and accurate result, which will require the equal contest of counseled adversary proceedings.
Judge?
Yes.
The question that bothered me as I read this material, and I think all the subsequent speakers, if they think it's a significant question, might think of how to answer it. This petition is based not on constitutional right per se, not like the Sixth Amendment criminal right. It's based on a fairness concept, which you could argue is a due process concept. And if it's based on a fairness, and a fairness, at least for our purposes today, equals due process, don't the judges have the right to do this now as part of the inherent power? They get a case and they think that counsel should be appointed for both sides or one side. And it doesn't fit into Joni B., and it doesn't fit into one of the statutory provisions for providing counsel in civil cases. Doesn't the judge now have the inherent power to appoint counsel?
Justice Abramson, I think that you're correct. I think my reading of Joni B. and simple principles of due process would indicate that judges do.
Right. But
I think statewide judges, number one, don't know that. Number two, if they do know that, they feel somewhat paralyzed and crippled by any kind of cost implications it may have, and I've heard that from judges. Again, judges want to be good stewards of public funds, but they also are certainly concerned, deeply concerned, about the cost of appointing counsel. So, while I think you're correct, and I feel that I do have the inherent authority, if I end up in cases where I have a litigant that needs counsel, that I could do it. But many judges, number one, don't know that. Number two, if they know that, don't feel very comfortable doing it. And I don't think it's just an issue of training judges. I've been doing juvenile law training every year for the last 4 years, and one of the issues that does come up is appointment of counsel under Joni B., and many of them don't realize, they think the statute is still in play, which indicates you can't appoint counsel in not child neglect cases, which was overruled by Joni B., or changed by Joni B. They don't even understand that. There's a lot for judges to know.
Right.
So I also think times it takes a cultural change, a change in how we see litigants in front of us to ensure that fairness.
So if I understand your answer, courts have the power now to do what this proposal says, but that they might not fully realize that and may be reluctant because of funding, and so that this proposal really doesn't change the power of the court. It just verbalizes that which is unwritten or not written specifically.
I would agree that it emphasizes that it can be applied in other cases besides child neglect cases. I think that's what judges need to hear as well. So I would agree with that.
Judge Trujano,
yes,
you focused your remark on basic human needs. That was the focus of what you were concerned with. If I would tell you you can pick only one, what one would you pick?
How much time do I have to ponder that?
I know it's a hard question.
I sit in the domestic violence courts, but I dare say that that would be the most important. I certainly think that Joni B. got it right, where your children, your family structure, including child neglect, termination of parental rights cases where we already can appoint, and family law cases where the family, the relationship is at stake, certainly would be one of the most important.
In domestic violence cases, though, often the defendant has counsel, because they're criminal charges that are brought forth, aren't they? So are you looking at counsel then for the victim, or what were you?
It would be in civil injunction hearings.
Okay.
Which we are handling in the criminal courts, but quite often I will see a victim who might have obtained an injunction, the respondent or the defendant asks for that to be overturned, and it comes to the courts on a de novo review. Many of those victims are unrepresented in those cases. That's where I now see the pro se, and the other side is represented by competent counsel. Very difficult for women under those circumstances, and it's mostly women, to be able to articulate what she needs, what she wants, and oftentimes knowing that the other side is represented may not even show up to protect herself.
Okay, thank you very much.
Judge, when Commissioner Keck testified, the question came up of whether a court commissioner would have the authority to make an appointment. What would your response be to that?
I was just talking to Judge Amahiro. I know there's a case where it's now the question of commissioners doing things in criminal cases is at issue, but I would emphasize, and I've done in many cases, that a court commissioner who can articulate the criteria that we all might decide on, like the criteria in Joanie B., should have the authority to do so. In my opinion, the sooner that we get counsel, the better off litigants are in resolving cases, looking at cases that have issues that might be crucial in the beginning, to steer them in one way or the other. So I would support a commissioner having that authority to do that as well.
Chief? Justice Bradley. I'll take the lead of Justice Rogensack and maybe expand. Give me one or two. Your third point dealt with not having to reinvent the wheel or starting from scratch. Other programs exist. Is there a program, or are there a couple of programs that you can briefly highlight?
Sure. The program that Milwaukee County Children's Court has in place, they actually had it in place, but I believe, before Joanie B., and my other colleagues can talk about that as well. But after Joanie B., the program continued. It is a panel of lawyers who are well-versed in child custody cases or child neglect cases, who stand by during different phases of a proceeding, most notably in a temporary physical custody proceeding. And if a judge believes that a litigant meets the criteria under Joanie B. and other criteria they might set, we can reach out and appoint an attorney early on in the proceedings who will handle the case on an ongoing basis for that litigant, that parent, in a child neglect case. Those persons are appointed by the court. They have standards. They have training that they have to comply with. I believe they are paid at a rate of $60 an hour, and the county reimburses them when they submit their bills. The judges all scrutinize those bills because they're the ones that had the case, so would review the bills and sign off to whether they think it's appropriate or not, and then they would get paid. So it is a program that's been there as long as I can remember. I certainly had the benefit of it, and I believe the judges appoint counsel in those cases, in the vast majority of cases, because those litigants under the criteria of Joanie B. need counsel.
Thank you. How does your self-help center work, do you know?
It is open during the court operations. Many judges refer clients down there or litigants down there when they think they might need some help in terms of forms. So does the clerks when they're entering any kind of data or processing petitions. Lawyers are there most of the time acting on a pro bono basis, helping give direction, sometimes filling out forms. It's another piece of the puzzle in terms of helping pro se litigants with their cases. The light's red.
Judge, yes. I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying because I've been there and I've sat in your seat. And I've seen the people come to court who wish they had a lawyer and couldn't afford a lawyer and really could have benefited from having a lawyer. So everything that has been said so far, and I expect, frankly, everything that's said all day, I'm going to understand and be very sympathetic to. Where the rubber hits the road, though, on this issue is who pays and how are you going to do it? And no one's really saying that, but I think it's important for every speaker who comes up to think about and address that issue, because that is going to be the sticking point, I think. If you're saying counties, and I heard you say, I think, counties will pay. Having been someone who's done budgeting with counties and gone before county boards to try to get a budget through, you know, there's a good amount of time the county says, we're not going to raise taxes, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that. And they just say, well, where do you want it to come from? Do you want us to eliminate your court commissioners? Do you want us to eliminate this? What can we eliminate in your budget to create this funding source? So, especially these days, I think we see counties strapped too. And if it's going to be a county expense, we have to think about what are we willing to give up? Court commissioners? I mean, that's one thing I heard personally in Washington County when I was talking about raising the rate for criminal defense lawyers and some other things, because we needed people to be appointed in criminal cases, and people wouldn't take them at the $40 rate. So we were sort of stuck. And it was important. It was a constitutional right. It was clear that we had the right to appoint those people. But it also became clear, at least from the county's perspective, that if this got pushed too much further, that there would be some take somewhere else. And the thing that was brought up then was eliminating court commissioners, which obviously increases the burden on the courts and delays everything if you can't get cases processed by having those people start the temporary proceedings. So I say that not to be a pessimist, not to be against this, because I am not against this, but just help me figure out how we make that happen. That's the piece that needs to fit so this can happen, I think.
Right. And Justice Ziegler, I certainly note the inherent issues concerning both of those, because it was grappled with in Joni B. versus State of Wisconsin as well. And again, judges deal with it all the time. I do think, however, that any cost analysis can't just entail the outlay of money to pay lawyers. It has to entail what I indicated before. What are the societal costs on the back end, where counties and the state might be paying a tremendous amount in that sense, and have those discussions at the table? I think those discussions need to go on with the county and the state to try to develop a program that is cost conscious and efficient, and to have those conversations and to invite people to the table to do that, because it's not an easy answer. I think John Abbott certainly in his petition has suggested places where those monies could come from. I somewhat feel uncomfortable even suggesting anything as a judge, knowing that if I have a litigant in front of me that needs that, what am I to do under the fairness, due process, Joni B. factors? Do I appoint or do I say, you know what, so sorry, I can't do it, and compromise my ability to create fairness in my court? So I think there are nationally and locally models that we can have those discussions about in terms of where's that money going to come from, instead of just saying, you know what, we can't afford it, so forget it.
I agree, there's a bigger picture, and this has ramifications that go much further than
there's where the rubber hits the road in all these discussions here today. How are we going to afford it? And then again saying, what if we don't? What if we continue on in the way we are, having those impacts to the judicial system and the societal impacts, and it becomes an issue of social policy? And I think this at least precipitates the conversation about how we can do that and work together.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm also authorized to say Judge Jane Carroll helped draft this deal. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Next, all the way from Monroe County, retired Judge Mike McAlpine. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I had prepared my remarks in writing so that I would accomplish two things. Number one, I wouldn't be too long, and two, I wouldn't miss the points that I wanted to make. And my remarks start out by addressing the Chief Justice and wishing you all good morning. I want you to know that it is an honor to be here. I have great respect for this institution and all of you who serve the people of the state of Wisconsin on this court. This is the second time that I've had the opportunity to be in the Supreme Court. The first was almost 35 years ago to the day. And my concern when Chief Justice Abramson got up is that she remembered me. In any event, I can tell you when I appeared before, I was nervous as a cat. Mm-hmm. And this is true despite the fact that I spent hours preparing to appear in the court. I'm not sure how many times I made my argument in front of the bathroom mirror, but my preparation was something that I felt very important. The day before I came down and spent the day at the library at the law school, the night before, I hardly slept a wink, and when I did, my dreams were of the lights on the podium. Well, the next day when I came for my argument, I was grateful that it was in the morning. And can you imagine the relief when I was told that my opponent had his office miscalendar the date of the argument? He thought that it was the following day. I was graciously given the opportunity to make my argument or rely on my brief. And it didn't take me long to say, thank you, I'll rely on my brief. And my suspicion was that the court appreciated the decision that I made. But this morning, I appear in support of the petition before the court. The petition, in my estimation, is one that is very significant for the interests of justice in the state of Wisconsin. This court, through its leadership, has taken a number of significant steps to provide access to the citizens of the state of Wisconsin to our courts. The court, with the petition that it has before it, now has, I think, really the terrific opportunity to enhance the access that people have to the court, such that that access is going to be effective in nature. We've expressed through the actions that have been taken really our strong commitment to justice in the state of Wisconsin. It has been my experience as an attorney and a circuit judge, both of which I value greatly in my life, that litigants who appear without counsel in court proceedings find themselves at a severe disadvantage. Their ability to prepare and participate effectively in court proceedings, I think in most instances, is limited at best. While their positions in the litigation that they're involved in may very well be just, their ability to advance their position is oftentimes difficult. Even though there are questions to be asked, there are documents and other evidence to be introduced and arguments to be made, they often do not have the ability to do that, and it places, I believe, the trial courts in very uncomfortable positions of having to decide whether or not they wish to in any way intervene in the litigation and perhaps even take the role of almost being counsel for one of the parties. Now, that's not something that happens, but believe me, there is a feeling as a judge that you want to make sure that the results of a case are ones that are just. correcting, however, the oversights of unrepresented litigants surely can suggest a departure from the trial court's responsibility to be impartial to all sides of a case. It has also been my experience as a circuit judge that when attorneys are involved in litigation, that oftentimes that litigation finds a way to be resolved before there's a great expenditure of time in the trial court. Attorneys have a wonderful function. Now, that doesn't suggest that all cases are capable of or are, in fact, subtle. Certainly, when litigants advance their own case, they often have great difficulty in understanding the rules that are involved. The opportunity to provide counsel for litigants who meet the criteria and whose basic human needs are ones that are at risk really, I think, speaks to what we all want to do, and that's to make sure that the cases that are heard in our courts are ones that end with just results. Now, I'm certainly mindful of the economic issues that are involved. And while I don't want to pass the buck, I perhaps am going to anyhow by saying to you that I know that others have and certainly will talk to you on this important subject. There are human costs, as Justice Ziegler recognized, and as I know all of you recognize. And those economic costs and human costs, I know, are ones that you will very thoughtfully and thoroughly consider in your deliberations. I appreciate the task that you have at hand. And I want to conclude my brief remarks by again thanking you for the opportunity to be here and to express to you that it is my fondest hope that in 35 years, I'll be able to come back to this court. Thank you.
Counselor, before you leave, Judge, I'd like to ask you a similar question that I asked Judge Trajano. If you could pick only one type of matter where we would experiment with this process that's been put before us in total, what kind of matter would you choose?
I've always thought, not only as an attorney, but as a judge, that one of the greatest responsibilities that we have are in those instances where a litigant's child or children are involved. Custody and placement issues are ones that I believe deserve, as do all the other matters, but this particular issue is very important.
That's the most important in your opinion. Thank you.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Counsel, other jurisdictions have selected particular matters, and they've selected particular areas of the state in which to deal with the matters for us appointing counsel. And California has a setup of where a particular, I think it's groups would apply for grants to represent people who cannot afford counsel. And so these are pilot programs, right?
Yes.
Rather than do statewide. So if the court was to adopt a pilot program of that, of appointing, that's of adopting this resolution, but relating only, say, to children, would you like Monroe County to be one of the counties?
Yes. I would be happy to let our media in Monroe County know today.
What about you?
Yes, it is.
Your county board.
I'm sorry?
Would you like to let your county board know that they're going to have an estimated, and I don't know what, it's very hard to estimate, so you'd be in trouble estimating, but just say a lot of money.
As you know, or may know, I'm retired, and I'm sure one of the three judges who is now sitting would be very happy to talk to our county board.
Okay. And you're going to help them.
Seriously, I would certainly do that. But, and I know that's a huge concern.
That is, and we ought to put it out on the table so everybody can deal with that. Although rights should not be determined by money, there still is difficulty in terms of finances. And as one of the very thoughtful people who wrote in said, you know, they agree with this in principle, but that when it got down to the money, then the county board or the state has to make choices between programs. And that makes it very difficult. So I think that it's sort of very important to put that out. So we all discuss that and realize that. But
yes.
We appreciate all your years of service, Judge.
All right.
And your continued service to the court system.
Thank you.
Justice Prosser.
Judge, there was a comment about the development of pro se forms when the commissioner testified. And then it was commented on that many times it's not clear which form to use, and that people in the clerk of court's staff are not authorized to give any advice in that respect. Should that rule be changed?
Well, I don't think that the clerks should be in the position of giving advice. Sure, they don't want to be in that position. Certainly, the clerks in our county, in Monroe County, do an excellent job by providing the information and instructions to pro se litigants. They don't go beyond that, though. And I hope I answered your question.
Well, as I understood it, perhaps I didn't understand it correctly, if a litigant doesn't know whether to use this form or that form, I gather that the clerk's office cannot say, use that form.
Correct.
Is that too limiting?
You know, it's a question that I haven't thought of. It is certainly a concern and goes along with the thought of the petition before the court. We want individuals to have as much information available to them as possible. Asking the clerks to advise them, though, I'm not sure is the right way to do. Having perhaps a system where there may be attorneys who, on a pro bono basis, are willing to offer some limited advice may very well be the answer.
This raises the issue of limited representation, and we have a couple of committees working on that doctrine so that it more clearly enables lawyers to give limited representation. And the clerks, I think, have a guidelines or a statement about what their powers are, and they're worried about unauthorized practice of law, as I understand it.
Sure.
And aren't we all?
Yes.
So thank you, Judge. Judge Thomas Donegan, Milwaukee County Circuit Court. Morning, Judge.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices of our Supreme Court. I thank you very much for hearing this petition today, and I also thank all of you who asked so many questions of Judge Trigiano because she said everything I have to say. So I'll try to fill in a few other blanks. I believe I've been asked to speak here for two reasons. First is that I've been a judge in Milwaukee County for 19 years and 2 months. During that time, I have been in the felony division, the civil division, including small claims court, and 10 of those years have been in children's court, and I am now back in children's court as of August 1st. So I think I have seen the system, how it works and it doesn't work. And most specifically, I'd like to address the impact of the Joni B. case in children's court, and secondly, how that experience could transfer to other divisions. As far as the Joni B. case, as many of you know, the children's court judges at that time were the plaintiffs. I was one of the plaintiffs, along with Judge Sheedy, our chief judge, saying we can't have the legislature telling judges you can't appoint lawyers. That's not their role. Judges have that inherent power, and you agreed. And you agreed that we have to determine whether they, in fact, need appointed counsel because they're indigent. We have to look at how serious those cases are, and we have to determine how complex they are, whether they really need an attorney. And the argument of the state in Joni B. was, once you open this door, look out. You get lawyers in these cases instead of social workers, and they're going to be filing flippant motions. They're going to be demanding trials when they don't need a trial. They're going to be litigious, and they're going to drag out these cases. You found the legislature can't void our power. You trusted the judges to use their inherent authority. So I'm now out of children's court under Joni B. The fact is, in Milwaukee County, poorest county in our state, with a certainly a serious financial burden, which all of us know. Nonetheless, under Joni B., I personally find it necessary, and most judges find it necessary, in almost 100% of our cases to appoint lawyers. Why? Because I have not met more than 1% of the parents who are able to afford counsel at any kind of normal private rate. Why? Because the cases are often complex. Picture the mother who has a social worker and cop remove her kids from her home, not tell the mother where those kids are, and tell them to be in court if they want to fight to get their kids back. Well, that's pretty complicated for these people who generally have low education, high mental health issues, often alcohol or drug issues. They're not going to be competent to adequately represent themselves. We face that in the front, and we appoint lawyers. The key is, how do you do it? So you save your county money as well as give fairness. And what we have done is set up standards that I think could be reflected in every county and every division in this state. And they would assure we're doing our jobs as lawyers. We're making sure there's fairness in our system. And I think that's at least as important as paving roads and keeping up the boulevards and making sure we have a nice zoo. We had better say we're the courts, and we know people need fairness. What else are we about if we're not about that? So what we've done, though, is try to make it as cost-effective as we can. So we have set up a system, and I can leave you with it with you, the Milwaukee County Children's Division intake attorney standards. And we set up guidelines. You want to practice law out here, be willing to do it for $60 an hour. You want to practice law, make sure that you have been at children's court, at least for some cases, over the last 2 years. Make sure that you agree to follow our CAP. That's the comprehensive assessment process. That requires you to make every effort to resolve CHIP's original jurisdiction cases no later than 90 days after the detention hearing. That requires we set down exactly how they have to contact their client and try to firm up their client's position between the initial detention hearing and the plea hearing. If they have incarcerated clients, we tell them they have to, by telephone or personal contact, notify that incarcerated parent of the proceedings, of their possible defenses, how they need to participate. They then are ordered that if, in fact, there is no response by that incarcerated parent, they're to notify the court, and the court generally relieves them of responsibility and defaults the parent. All of that brings efficiency. According to the Bureau of Milwaukee Child Welfare in Milwaukee, 69% of our families in children's court are reunited within 12 months of that detention hearing that we held. You look back 10 years, and it was more than double the time. So you have to look at all the costs. Yes, it costs $60 an hour to appoint a lawyer, but it costs a lot less because we don't have social workers on these cases for 5 years. They might be on for 12 months. We are resolving cases more quickly. We're trying to abide by what John Velker, the director of state courts, after meeting with the committee of chief judges, set out as a guideline for us, telling us in CHIPS cases, your goal is to resolve 85% of your cases within 90 days. So if we're being told, here's your CHIPS processing guideline, this is how quickly you should do it, and then we're told you can't have lawyers representing these people, that guideline's meaningless. Fairness is meaningless. Any semblance of judicial process is meaningless. And we have to trust the lawyers. They're members of the bar. We tell them these are your guidelines. You have to follow them. We're not saying file frivolous motions and have extensive trials. And the fact is, I picked up a calendar from Judge Rosa, who had the calendar I now have for 4 years. In his 4 years, he told me he had won CHIPS trial. It got resolved. Why did it get resolved? Because you don't have the angry mother with the three angry alleged fathers fighting about five kids. You have lawyers who've talked to their clients, told them here's what you might be able to prove or not prove, and worked them towards settlement. So we resolve cases quicker. I think that same kind of thing could be done in the civil division. You asked Justice, what kinds of cases? Well, let's look at the foreclosure issue. People are being thrown out of their houses right and left. Many of those cases are simple. A judge can't, in good faith, appoint a lawyer.
Counselor, Judge, if you could pick one kind of case, well, would let you me pick that foreclosure? One for one. Is that what
not,
you pick?
Not only, but it jumps to mind that that's where a judge is important. They read all the cases. They've got 30 foreclosures scheduled for default. Most of them look routine. The parties don't show up. You can't help. But they might have that one where there appears to be an affidavit that you don't know if there's a basis for that. There are some tricky financing questions that you wonder, is this a little more complex than most? Maybe I should appoint a lawyer for this person who appeared in court, who raised some what might be possible defenses, and I want a lawyer to look into that, to dig a little deeper and see if here we have something that will show the bank was fraudulent or it's a bigger case than they just didn't pay.
My question, Judge, was really trying to borrow on your experience in the courtroom, which I don't have, to make you pick one case, one type of case, if we couldn't buy the whole package. And if foreclosure is what you would pick, that's fine. That's a help to me to know that.
I know that's your question, and I cannot see the issue that way. I'd rather say the judges have to look at, in the whole, whether it's foreclosure, a children's court, you could have a contract case. That, you know, you might have a simple contract case on its face, but as you look at the file, you begin to question whether or not there are some tougher legal issues than in most cases, and if this person's unrepresented, they're down the tubes. They lose their house, they lose everything.
Well, if your answer was children, you could still bring in foreclosure. Because one of the problems on foreclosure is that the family is out of a home.
Right.
The family may be homeless. The kids are homeless. They're now in school, homeless, living in a shelter or some other facility that's temporary. So, I mean, if you say children, we still have a problem of what cases affect children. Obviously, custody affects children. Obviously, support affects children. But obviously, foreclosure can affect children. And
school expulsion cases can affect children.
School expulsion case. We just had one discipline of a child, which wasn't presented as a child case, but a power case between courts and the school system. But so if you, whatever topic is picked, can have broad ramifications across the lines. And of course, foreclosure happens to be a very large area of the law that's now being put before judges.
Find families, neighborhoods, tax base, everything. Sure. We could find many cases. I think the judge has to look at the individual case and say, what are the ramifications of this case? How serious it is, how important it is to meet basic needs. And I know we have the inherent power, but I agree, inherent authority, but I agree with Judge Trigiano. So many judges don't exercise it. And I think it's an opportunity to say, come on, judges, we have a role here. Exercise that inherent authority judiciously.
I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Judge McAlpin. If we had a pilot program, you want Milwaukee in it?
I think we are in it under Joni B. Take a look at what we're doing. Milwaukee County obviously didn't want you to decide the way you did, Joni B. Milwaukee County's surviving with it. Yeah. We
but
are
I mean,
judicious.
If you extend Joni B. Right. I mean, they keep the expression is extend. I'm not sure that's the right verb, but I'll use it for the moment. So would you like Milwaukee to participate in that? You go to the Milwaukee County Board?
I really would not have any difficulty at all with that. I'd love us to take the lead.
Justice Bradley.
Milwaukee County has weighed in on this petition. They filed a resolution that was passed. And the resolution says we're in support of it. But. As long as
there's always the but.
As long as the state pays for it. And in the cover letter with the resolution that was filed with us, they make the assertion that if it's going to be expanded, you know, what we're doing now is fine, essentially, as I read the cover letter, but if it's going to be expanded, the money's going to have to come from someplace. Quote, if we are forced to bear the costs of 10.08, the number assigned to this petition, other areas of service, they set forth some, will have to be cut.
Not necessarily, but, you know, I looked through John Ebbett's multiple-page document in support of this, where he lists potential sources and court fees and general revenue and... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tried to stay awake during it, and there are sources. We can always find it if we're looking. It's a hard one. It's a hard one. Why? Because people want their roads, they want to pay less taxes, and they're not that concerned about some poor, non-tax-paying family and children's court. So I don't know all the answers. I could look through John's memo and say, well, this one looks good to me. Let's
well, you
try
know,
that.
I did look through it. Most of them would require legislation. I mean, you can't shift from A to B to C in statutory or budget language without legislation or
well, some
using...
Some simpler legislation than others, I think.
Yeah.
Again, dedicating a fee.
Or using what might be arguably this court's power to say, hey, fund it, period.
But couldn't we also set a cap, you know, fund it up to this cap in this county? We could look for some grants to help supplement so we can actually test the results. You know, Milwaukee County, as I said, we're paying $60 an hour to attorneys. Average costs are less than $700 a case. We could estimate that out. In a civil area, I think it'd be much less. There are fewer cases that are both affecting basic needs and that complex than a family that were tearing apart in children's court.
As Justice Bradley pointed out, what Milwaukee County did, but there's also in their filings, all of which are on the web, that the county association also said, hey, sounds like a good idea. We're not opposed to it. We understand it, but... It is a financial
issue.
Didn't
we and Joni B., though, have the same people saying the same thing? every time we say we have to do something, you know, build this courthouse. Well, it costs money. Yeah, well, it's worth it to have a courthouse where we show we respect justice. I just think we have to bite that bullet somewhere. We can't keep putting aside justice for roads. At least that's my thought.
Thank you very much, Judge. Judge Glenn Yamahiro of the Milwaukee County Circuit Court.
Good morning. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, I greatly appreciate this opportunity to address the Court regarding the rule petition. In my own experience as a judge, court commissioner, attorney, social worker, counselor, I've been working with the populations that would be most affected by this petition for almost 30 years. I think we're all aware that in most cases we're talking about people who are uneducated or undereducated, unskilled, oftentimes mentally ill, substance addicted, and also survivors of domestic sexual abuse or other trauma. I think that the recent economic downturn has added an additional multitude of people who are finding themselves a subject of civil litigation, a defense against which they are not prepared to finance. I think the Court is well aware of the burdens that this has placed on our trial courts and our judges who strive for justice, as well as the preservation of fundamental fairness in our civil justice system. As the economic divides in our society continue to erode the middle class and create ever-deepening divisions between those with and without means, our judicial challenge of producing just results and maintaining public confidence in the courts is becoming increasingly difficult. I am hopeful that the Court will demonstrate leadership and take unprecedented action to strengthen the integrity and delivery of justice in civil cases in Wisconsin. So those are the official remarks. And then I guess I'll just say that I agree with Judge Trigiano, Judge Donegan, and try and address some of the questions that have been raised by the Court. I do agree that the circuit court judges have inherent authority pursuant to the Joni B. decision to make decisions about appointment of counsel in civil matters. But I think reality dictates that our circuit court judges struggle to maintain judicial independence in the day-to-day realities of local politics and local budgetary issues. I believe that the issues that impact the fundamental quality of justice in the civil system should be addressed by the highest court and not left to the trial courts to solve individually or under the current state of the law. I think that the verb that perhaps the Chief Justice was looking for was clarity as opposed to expansion when it comes to the inherent authority of courts to appoint counsel under the Joni B. decision and also under this petition. Obviously, one of the benefits of this petition is that it provides clarity to under what circumstances, in a general sense, appointment of counsel should be made. I think that this Court can also give us guidance, as it did in Joni B., as to what factors should be considered in a given subject area. In Joni B., there were a number of criteria set forth in that decision as to what factors judges should consider in deciding whether or not to appoint counsel, and I see no reason why this could not be done in other subject matters, whether it's done in the context of a case or whether it's done by amendments to the judicial code or comments within the code. I think perhaps provide a more readily available vehicle to convey that important information to judges. Certainly, we have some structural bases to begin the discussion as to when to appoint, based upon the United States Supreme Court's cases and decisions, the Matthews versus Eldridge decision, the Turner v. Rogers decision, the Lassiter decision. I think all provide a basic framework that we can add upon give courts guidance as to when appointment of counsel is necessary. I don't view the petition of Mr. Ebbett to be one that's requesting appointment of counsel in all civil cases. And I think that's another area. I know there's been a lot of questioning this morning about trying to prioritize civil legal needs, which is a very difficult process. It's a process that I, frankly, was hopeful might begin to be addressed through the Access to Justice Commission that I had an opportunity to serve on as a WSSTAF representative. But, you know, those are hard discussions and hard decisions. In response to Justice Rogensack, I think it's virtually impossible to select one area. I agree that the Chief Justice's comments that, you know, there are a number of these areas that impact the lives of children. And, you know, if this is done with an eye towards what might fly politically, I suppose children are one of our safer bets, certainly better than historically than the poor and the bar have been in terms of political popularity. So I also want to address the statements that were originally raised by Justice Ziegler and also by the Chief with regard to a cost. My position is it's not our job. We got two other branches of government who are responsible for deciding how they're going to allocate their resources, and we have a bottom-line responsibility as a judiciary and as a justice system to ensure a minimum level of justice and fundamental fairness in our courts. And that is going downhill, in my estimation, based upon economics, based upon the crush of pro se litigants, and I don't see any turning back from the increase in that problem. So essentially, it's a question of priorities for the other two branches of government. I think you need look no further than the history of funding of civil legal services. Why is it that the state of Minnesota, I think, was able to include in their budget $10 or $11 million towards civil legal services, and only through the previous administration was any money even put in the budget for those same things in Wisconsin. So I don't think it's a function of, well, if we're going to have civil legal representation for an expanded group of people, then you get no court commissioners, or it's automatically going to be taken out of another piece of the court's budget. There are many areas where the other branches of government choose to allocate resources, and, one of the things in Mr. Ebbett's petition, even under his, which he admits, are in large part speculative economic analysis, because it's a very difficult subject to wrap your arms around in projecting that, I think he came out to one percentage of 1% of the state budget. So we do have a history of success in Milwaukee County with regard to the CHIPS cases, and I just want to piggyback on what just Judge Donegan and Judge Trigiano said. I was there for 3 years, and in the children's court, I did one jury trial during that time on a CHIPS case. Do I think that would have been the case if we were going with pro se litigants as a majority? Absolutely not. So there is a role here. I certainly do not have an issue with self-help clinics or other innovative programs that are limited, that have been implemented to help pro se individuals navigate parts of the system. But these tools are not a substitute for quality legal representation once we get beyond simple matters. Justice?
Thanks. Judge, do you expect that the standards for appointment of counsel in civil cases would be the same indigency standards that apply in criminal cases?
I can't think of a reason why they wouldn't be. Whether or not, I mean, obviously at this point, you know, especially when you think in context of the foreclosure crisis, we now have a large additional group of people in the courts that might be called working poor. people that may or may not quite fit on one side of the indigency analysis, but are certainly not in a position to retain counsel. You know, in some of our criminal cases, we have made similar appointments and made payment arrangements in the future for people to reimburse for their legal services. I don't know that that could not be expanded in some form for people that fall outside of the guidelines, but I don't see a reason not to use those guidelines in the civil context.
Of course, in the criminal context, you have the public defender's office, which is really helpful in taking a certain amount of cases of indigent individuals that are charged with crimes. But then the court appointments, everything would be a court appointment in the civil arena. But you don't expect that there would be disparate treatment between the two systems. That's the long and the short of my question. Do you expect that someone might receive a lawyer in a civil case, whereas if they were charged criminally, they wouldn't qualify or be appointed a lawyer?
I don't believe that would be an issue. And now that the legislature's updated the guidelines from whenever it was, the 1970s or 80s, frankly, I've not had to make very many appointments in criminal cases.
Thank you.
I don't know what a criminal one is. My reading in this was that it's 200% of the federal indigency standard. So we can ask Mr. Abbott about that, but I just don't know if that's the criminal one. I have a question for you in that you related what is currently being done, and Mr. Abbott's petition in a memorandum gave me the opportunity to go back and look at the December 2000 Wisconsin Pro Se Working Group, which is a committee of my office, on meeting the challenge of self-represented litigants. And so we did that. And then we've done pro se forms and pro se instructions, including in Spanish, and it may be other languages by now. We're working on limited representation. We've worked with the bar, both the local bars and the state bar, on pro bono representation. We've worked with the counties and with the bar on self-help clinics across the state, some more generous and more time than others. We worked with the law schools in providing clinic programs to help the judges and to help in pro se. We've worked with right now the University Law School, and maybe Ms. Mansfield will talk about that, has a program for students to do pro bono work and along with lawyers. We put in a $50 assessment on lawyers that raises what? $750,000. We put in IOLTA, that's the using the trust fund interest, which of course has substantially decreased in recent years, and with staff to do pro bono. We do judicial training in how two judges should handle cases in which one side or both sides are not represented. This report suggested simplifying evidence rules. Well, Daubert may make it more complicated on evidence. There are suggestions that we simplify and streamline substantive rules of law. Other jurisdictions are looking at simplifying procedure for everybody, lawyers and non-lawyers. So that's what we've done in the last 10 years. Now, when this program got started, Mr. Abbott came up to me and said, won't work, Band-Aid, problem too big. And I said, well, you got to start somewhere. And a Band-Aid may be better than nothing. So what I hear is the Band-Aids aren't good enough. Right?
Is that what we've reached that point, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Um,
Judge Gramling, Milwaukee Municipal Court, retired. I don't believe you've retired, Mr. Gramling. Good to see you.
Good morning. Chief Justice and members of the court, I think my testimony will be exceptionally brief because I'm sure the question of relevance comes to your mind or will shortly. Maybe he worked in municipal court for 21 years, but what possible relevance can he offer on the question before the court today? And I believe I was invited to speak largely because of my experience with unrepresented participants in the legal system over the 21 years that I served in Milwaukee Municipal Court. Consistently over the years, the municipal judges in the state have estimated that 95% of the people appearing in municipal court are unrepresented. And of course, municipal court cases aren't the types of cases that would be subject to the proposed rule. But I wanted to offer at least my brief thoughts about my experience as a judge in dealing with pro se participants in municipal court. Lack of representation wasn't a big deal on the garden variety traffic cases, of course, the kind that come into court where people are looking to save a few demerit points. But where the issues arose were in contested cases, particularly in non-traffic cases, where unrepresented parties were posed against an attorney, the city attorney, who typically called an authority figure, a police officer, as a main witness. On the other side of the courtroom, I looked at a solitary defendant, generally someone unskilled at handling legal proceedings. And I think that this scenario raises a couple of issues, and one is the complacency that I believe can arise in a system when a lack of tension exists, and the other is the risk that arises of an erroneous decision on the part of the judge. Now, I believe some level of tension needs to exist in an adversarial system. Of course, too much tension in a court system can be a problem, too, but that's another matter. Now, by tension, I mean the vigorous advancement of competing positions, the presentation of novel theories, a direct challenge to witness credibility, and a correction of stale judicial thinking. Without these features, a system can become complacent and the search for justice cabined. And I submit to you that over time, if the testimony of an authority figure goes unchallenged in a court system, there's a risk that that testimony can take on an enhanced and unwarranted credibility. And I further submit, although we train and educate our judges in a remarkable way, there still are pockets of uncertainty and lack of knowledge that persist. The appearance of opposing counsel, even if occasional, can go a long way toward making sure that creative tension exists in a courtroom. With respect to erroneous decisions, certainly everybody in this room shares the desire to see them eliminated. In my work, I had the feeling in trial after trial that I hadn't heard everything necessary to making a proper decision. And those of you who have served as trial judges probably had the same experience. And how could we expect otherwise? It is not an overstatement to describe many in the pro se category as unskilled, uneducated, and unsophisticated. When asked to follow proper trial procedures or rules of evidence, they struggle. On many occasions, I would see defendants in my courtroom simply slump in their chairs, and they essentially tuned out, they shut down. As a result, the rest of the story, the part that is necessary to a fair decision, goes untold. What the judge is left with, then, is the testimony often of the police officer or other authority person called in on behalf of the plaintiff or the city in my case, which the judge has to either accept or in some manner find to be unbelievable. So will the risk of an erroneous decision reach an unacceptably high level under these circumstances? I believe the answer is yes, and where the stakes reach a critical threshold, I believe there is a duty to provide counsel. You've heard probably more compelling testimony than mine and will throughout the day, but I believe this is a proposal that has exceedingly high merit, and I urge you to adopt it.
Judge, I think you are the second witness who said that you were invited to testify.
Yes.
Who invited you?
Well, I participated in a lot of discussion, Justice Prosser, over the last 4 years over how to raise this issue best. And those who organized the effort to analyze the issue and decide how to best present it, whether to the court, the legislature, John Ebbett was, you might say, the organizer of the effort. And John asked me whether I would be willing to testify this morning. And I happily said yes.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to see you again, and I know you're still working in the court system for access to justice for all people, and we commend you for all you did as a municipal judge and are still doing. Thank you,
Chief. Thank you very much.
I'm going to take a five-minute break, and then we're going to get to you, Justice Johnson. Will that disturb your plane trip back? You're okay? All right. 5 minutes.
reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Justice Earl Johnson, scholar in residence, Weston Center on Law and Poverty. Thank you for coming, and you also submitted a written communication that the court has and has
read. I do not plan to repeat that for the
next
2 or 3
much.
Hours.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Abramson and Justices of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, it is truly an honor and a pleasure to speak with you today about what many lawyers, judges, and other people consider the fundamental question facing the American justice system. That question is whether we are going to make the adversarial system work for the many who can't afford lawyers and aren't among the fortunate few who the handful of legal aid lawyers and pro bono counsel can represent. In a sense, this visit to Wisconsin is a bit of deja vu for me. The first time I was in Madison was a wintry 10 below zero day in February 1966.
That was a fluke most of the time it's like today.
I was born and raised in South Dakota, so I was used to that. And I was here at that time as deputy director of the OEO Legal Services Program to meet at the Wisconsin State Bar Association headquarters about a different Wisconsin initiative, the nation's first proposal for a Judicare program. We made that grant for what was supposed to be a 2 or 3 year experimental period. And now, 45 years later, we still have Wisconsin Judicare. And I note that they heartily endorse this new proposal. So I'm not at all surprised that Wisconsin is once again in the forefront with a new and different approach to the worst problem facing America's justice system. You've already heard testimony from Wisconsin's trial judges expressing their frustration with trying to reach correct and just decisions when litigants appear in their courts without lawyers. And that's no surprise. Ours isn't, as we all know, an adversary system that depends on legally trained and knowledgeable advocates working for the competing parties and expect them to do the heavy lifting. Those lawyers are expected to identify the applicable law and find the relevant facts, assemble that information in a coherent package, and present it in a clear fashion to a neutral decider, whether a judge or jury. That adversary system, as we also all know, breaks down when neither side has a lawyer and judges have to try to do from the bench all the work that should have happened before the parties came to court. And the judge's task becomes far more difficult when one side has a lawyer and the other doesn't. Inevitably, the judge is presented with a skewed version of the law and facts and faces a practical impossibility and an ethical minefield if attempting to bring balance to the contest. So I'm very pleased to see the proponent of the proposed rule has decided to amend his request to add the presence of counsel on the other side as a key factor trial judges are to consider when exercising their discretion to appoint counsel. Tell laymen they can pick up enough knowledge and skill in just a few hours at a self-help center or the equivalent, enough skill and knowledge to effectively represent themselves against full-fledged lawyers in our adversary system is an insult to the legal profession and a fraud on these litigants. It just can't be done.
It is shocking, but not surprising to learn that when the Rule of Law Commission recently rated countries on the access they provide low-income citizens, the United States ranked dead last among developed nations. Not surprising, because after all, nearly all European countries and many elsewhere in the world have long had statutory rights to counsel in civil cases. And backing up those statutory rights are constitutional rights to counsel in civil cases in a number of those countries, often based on constitutional language simply guaranteeing all rights equality before the law.
Justice Johnson, I read your memo, and I read a long communication from Northeastern mm-hmm. University. And I had the opportunity to attend a conference with the author of that letter on the significance of comparative international law, foreign law, and international law on state courts. And here's a good example. And as I read it, I kept thinking, okay, you can have a statutory right, you can have a constitutional right, and prior speakers say it's well recognized that there's an inherent right, that the courts have an inherent authority to provide fairness in the administration of justice in the court, which includes appointing counsel. So you have that. Everybody seems to agree the court trial judges could do that now, maybe should do that now. That doesn't mean they're actually doing it. So my question for you about international law and foreign law is, okay, are they really doing it? Are they really providing counsel to in civil cases?
Yes, they are, because it is not a discretionary power to appoint. It is either a statutory or a constitutional right, similar to the right to counsel that we have under Gideon in the United States in criminal cases.
And how do they pay for it?
Well, they're willing to invest more money, substantially more money, in providing counsel for low-income people than we have been in the United States, anywhere from 3 times as much to 10 times as much.
Sort of hard for Americans to believe that, or it's hard for this American to believe it.
I know. I've been talking about this for more than 2 decades.
I heard you, Mr. Johnson.
I tell the story, I have to convince people that it's the truth, but it's the truth.
Is it the same kind of adversary system we have?
It is in some countries, because it's common law countries like England have it, and New Zealand and Australia and so forth, many of them have that. They are certainly common law countries. And there are, which clearly use the adversarial system. But in some of the other countries, it's not the adversarial system, and so the need for lawyers presumably would be less, but they still provide lawyers as a matter of right. In Switzerland, it became a constitutional right to counsel in civil cases in 1937, 25 years before Gideon. They were doing it in civil cases before we even got around to getting in criminal cases. And all they were doing was interpreting a provision of their constitution that said all Swiss are equal before the law. And they took a look at the situation where an indigent couldn't afford a lawyer and said they can't be equal before the law without a lawyer, and therefore there's a right to counsel that has to be provided by the governments of the cantons.
Which Wisconsin did in the 1850s for criminal cases, mm-hmm. for felonies.
Yes, yeah. We did in California starting in 1872, but we were later arriving. We were only a state in 1850s, became a state in 1850s.
But you're catching up.
We're catching up. I know. It's a slow process. And, you know, the European Court on Human Rights on the European continent in 1979 in a case called Erie v. Ireland, they looked at a provision of the European Convention that guaranteed a fair hearing, quote and unquote, to anybody in a civil case and determined that for indigents that couldn't have lawyers, they couldn't have a fair hearing, and therefore the government had to establish a right to counsel. That's essentially continent-wide at this stage.
If you were redrafting this petition, would you change anything in it?
The only thing I would change is the change that they made.
And that
I think
been,
that, just go ahead.
That had been suggested by a number of the, or at least a couple of people who had written to us, if my count is right.
Mm-hmm. The change I think is important is the one that makes one of the factors whether or not there's counsel on the other side. I think that is the worst of all possible situations.
What about the list of cases, high human rights cases? Would you add to that list, subtract from the list? Would you, if we were doing a pilot program a la California, would you pick a particular program or pick a particular subject matter?
I think that's something that if you're going to talk about what a single subject matter that should be, that's something for the judges in this state to resolve. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that with the pilot program we're doing, the Sargent-Shriver Council program,
right.
Over half...
Which is legislative. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And over half of, in making the selections of the among the various applicants for who's going to get
right.
these pilot grants, over half of the money is going for the housing area, which is a combination of eviction cases, housing condition cases, and foreclosures,
mm-hmm.
With child custody being the second most frequent mm-hmm. recipient and the second one that's getting the most money.
And the grants were supposed to have been made October 1, were they?
The grants were actually made in July. October 1, the money was released.
Okay.
January 1st, the projects are going to start.
Okay. So the grants have been made. Got the money?
Yes. October 1st, the money was released.
Okay.
And now they're starting to hire, gear up and all that. I'm going to start actually operating January 1st.
I notice your time is up, so we ought to... even though you've spent a lot of time getting here.
All I want to do is say that I urge this court to take this step. It's not a baby step. It's a meaningful step, yet measured, toward making justice for all a reality in this state. If not our Constitution, let's let our consciences be the guide. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ebbett, John Ebbett, Executive Director of Legal Action of Wisconsin, and the petitioner. We usually give the petitioner more time, but we've got at least 20 speakers after you. So how much time do you think you were promised?
Well, since I think the court accommodated my request to cede 7 or 8 minutes to Attorney Michael Greco, past president of the American Bar Association. My estimation is I've been promised about 10 minutes.
Fair enough, counsel. You even sliced off 2 minutes, and I appreciate that.
May it please the court, honorable justices. My name is John Ebbett. I'm executive director of Legal Action of Wisconsin, and I appear today in support of rule petition 10-08. First of all, let me express the appreciation of the petition signers for your willingness to hold a public hearing today on this petition. I watched your calendaring conference on June 1st, and that drove home to me how difficult it is for you to fit all your duties into a schedule and how precious is your time. So we very much appreciate your making time for this hearing today. I'd also like to express our appreciation for the excellent work of Court Commissioner Julie Rich in preparing for this hearing. It has been very much a pleasure to work with Julie.
She says you've been very good to work with, too, and we want to thank you.
Well, that's a change of pace for me. Over the past two or three years, I traveled around the state visiting courthouses with my lawn chair and my card table and my poster board sign, gathering signatures for this petition. At the Marathon County Courthouse in Wausau, a woman approached my card table. She was distraught and panicked. She was crying. She said, "He didn't listen to anything I said. He only listened to the landlord. He hardly let me say anything. He told me I have a week to get out of the apartment. I have four kids. What am I going to do?" So what indeed was she going to do? We had a case of legal action where really we caught the family too late after the damage had been done. This case involved a 46-year-old woman who had cancer. She was disabled. And she had an 8-year-old daughter. She had been sued. Both of them actually were named defendants. They were sued in eviction by a management company. Since she had no lawyer, she entered into an ill-advised eviction stipulation whereby she agreed to leave their apartment with no place to live but their van. This was in the middle of January. For most of those winter days and nights, from January through mid-April, that little girl, I practiced this and I didn't do this, that little girl had only that van on the street to call home. She had no heat except for the van's heater and some blankets. Imagine what it is like for a young girl to spend close to 90 winter nights in a motor vehicle on a street and not in a home. Imagine what it is like for a mother to realize that this is all that she can do for her daughter. All the prisoners in the Wisconsin penal system were warmer on those nights than was that little girl. Because they had an eviction action during the past 5 years, they were denied housing 6 times by housing providers during that period. As it turned out, the management company which brought the eviction action had acted on behalf of a limited liability company which had been foreclosed on and no longer had title to the building. Even the management company no longer existed because it had been administratively dissolved prior to the commencement of the eviction action. This defense and the counterclaims flowing from it were not raised by the mother and daughter because they had no lawyer to help them. Instead, they agreed to move to the street. We simply cannot continue to let these things happen to people. It is not right. Many of us were taught as children that it is a moral imperative to give justice to the weak and the fatherless, to maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute, and to rescue the weak and the needy. Others of us were taught that righteousness is in one who gives wealth, in spite of love for it, to orphans, the needy, and those who ask for help. Yet we don't do these things in our civil courts. This rule should be adopted because it is the right thing to do. And now is the time to adopt this rule, not later on down the road. I recently read through the transcripts of 4 of the hearings that were held by the State Bar's Skilton Commission in 1995. That testimony could have been given yesterday. So little has changed in 16 years. There has been some progress, those things listed by the Chief Justice. There's been progress in many areas, but the need for appointed attorneys in civil cases was as glaring in 1995 as it is today. If we don't act, the crisis will get much, much worse over the next 16 years. And in the meantime, countless injustices will be visited upon those who have no voice and no power and no one to help them. There will never be a time when county and state governments have piles of cash at their elbows about which they say, "We have this extra money. What on earth should we do with it? I know. Let's give it to the courts for lawyers for poor people." That'll never happen. We're told that we can't afford this. We're asked where will the money come from, to the point that one would think that if there's no money for this basic element of fundamental fairness and justice, there's probably no money for any other public purpose. But I looked at some county budgets. One county spends $1 million a year on its fairgrounds. Half of that amount would support 250 attorney appointments at $2,000 a case. Another county spends almost $1 million on its snowmobile and all-terrain vehicle trails. Again, that would support around 250 attorney appointments. One county spends 20% of its budget $18 million on its sheriff's department. Another county spends $12 million on the sheriff. Roads get considerable financing. One county spends $10 million on its roads, another $30 million. One county's capital budget provides for the replacement of a model year 2002 pickup truck used by one of the departments at a cost of $36,000. The mere deferral of that purchase for 1 year would support 18 attorney appointments at $2,000 per case. I'm not, when I say this, I'm not saying these are the areas that money should be taken from to support appointed counsel. I'm raising these because they're areas that don't involve money for children and old people and human services. But there are pots of money in county budgets. But I'm not saying, yeah, well, you ought to take it from the fairgrounds. I'm just raising this as the fact that there are other pools of money in county budgets than human services or assistance to children or old people.
Counselor, what you say implies that if we institute a program like this, the money will be taken from some other place in the county budget, which I think is a correct assumption. Have you done any research to see if there are any either private charitable foundations or other organizations that grants might be had to partially fund something like this?
I have not done research to see whether there are grants available for this specific thing, but I know from legal actions experience over the last 10 years that I think that's absolutely not a possibility to the degree that it's necessary. The foundations used to fund advocacy, and now they shy away even from the term advocacy. So I haven't done a direct answer to your question. I haven't done research, but our experience is that this money would not be available.
You raise money for your legal action, don't you? Don't you try and raise money for legal action?
But I'm saying that it's very difficult for us to raise.
So you have to. You're assuming that if you can't raise it for legal action, it's going to be hard to raise it for a statewide legal action program of one sort or other.
Well, if it's from private foundations, I think it, in the dimensions necessary, it's going to be very difficult. And the other signal feature of foundations is they like you to give them a pilot proposal, and then they say at the end of the application, how are you going to continue this funding over the years when we stop funding you?
Well, but there are other things. For example, I checked around and there's CyPRE, you know, that class actions, when there's money left over, there's legislation or judicial rulings that money should go to a fund services, civil services for the indigent. I don't know how much we'd be able to get in Wisconsin for that.
I don't think very much. I mean, I don't see the courts applying to various foundations, and I mean, the courts could direct some CyPRE funds to this purpose, but I don't see it coming even close.
The other thing I read about in trying to think about funding was that, and I think it's statutory, that a part of any punitive damages would go to fund legal services.
We take every dollar that would come, but I
understand. I think I haven't given this a great deal of thought, and I'm not ruling from the bench. But it seems to me both of those would require some sort of legislative action to do that. And so I'm just looking for techniques that other states have used to fund matters.
Well, they have used those techniques, but it's not sufficient. I mean, the $2.5 million that legal services had from state appropriations was not enough, and now that's been totally eliminated. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the courts looking to some of these other funding sources to adequately fund this, I don't think it would happen. I wanted to make a point about the state-level budget. My raising these pools of funding on the state level was not because I think that the court must order the legislature to dedicate the funds to this. I don't think that's the way it would work. The court issues a rule telling its trial court judges to appoint counsel under these criteria. Trial court judges appoint counsel, as they have in the past, and then counsel bills the county and the county pays. So it's not a matter of this, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin ordering the Wisconsin legislature to fund this.
You're expecting the county to go to the state to get the money.
My expectation is that the counties would get together and say it's difficult for us to afford this, let's go to the state. And as the court knows, that's what the counties and the court did on the court services surcharge, is went to the legislature to try to get that. And so what I'm trying to point out is, especially with the court support services surcharge, there are some pools of money there, and that one in particular was supposed to go to help counties fund the courts, and the legislature has not given it up. So what I want to make clear is I'm not saying that this court is going to have to order the legislature. I don't think there's a separation of powers issue. So in my view, the words uttered in 1848 by James Lewis, who was a delegate to the Wisconsin Constitutional Convention, ring true today with regard to this. But now they are so monstrous poor, they must dispense with justice because the people are too poor. No, sir, this is no argument at all. What we are asking this court will take courage on the part of the court. It will not be popular in some quarters, but it will honor Wisconsin's historic commitment to equality and to fundamental fairness. And I close with the words of a great American leader who died too soon. Few men are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, the wrath of society. Moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Yet it is the one essential, vital quality for those who seek to change a world which yields most painfully to change. So we'd ask the court to grant this petition and promulgate the rule, and I thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you, Mr. Abbott. And you will have an opportunity at the end to make a summation also, but you have to remember me. I'm sorry. Justice Prosser?
That's all right.
Justice Prosser cedes his time. But he can get you at the end.
Okay.
All right.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Michael Greco, American Bar Association past president. Thank you, Mr. Greco, for coming and for your written comments. And on behalf of the court, I want to thank the American Bar Association for all their efforts relating to state courts and funding of state courts and addressing other issues that state courts face today in the 21st century.
Thank you. May it please the court. I am Michael Greco of Boston, Massachusetts. On behalf of the American Bar Association, I thank the court for the opportunity to speak in support of Petition 10-8, which seeks to amend this court's Rule 11.02. I have filed with the clerk of court a letter dated September 9, 2011, which provides greater detail on the points I wish to make briefly in this oral presentation. There are three reasons why this court should grant the petition. First, there exists in Wisconsin and in all the states a wide justice gap between the legal needs of indigent civil litigants and the legal assistance that is made available to them. It is a gap that begs to be addressed by this court. Second, the proposed amendment to Rule 11.02 is cost-effective and will result in significant societal and economic benefits in Wisconsin, while easing the mounting financial pressures on the courts of Wisconsin. And third, the proposed rule is a necessary and long overdue step by this court to help achieve equal justice for all in Wisconsin. My remarks are really intended to provide the court with a national perspective on what's been happening throughout our country in the last several years on the subject of this petition request. So how wide is the justice gap nationwide and in Wisconsin? Studies conducted by many states and the ABA from 1987 to 2009 repeatedly have documented that every year at least 80% of the legal needs of indigent persons in our country go unaddressed. In the past several years, the desperate need for civil legal aid to eligible persons has been exacerbated, as we know, by a great and ongoing economic recession. The need for legal aid continues to increase dramatically, while the aid provided holds at the 20% level or lower. Nationally respected public interest lawyer, writing in the September 13 edition of the National Law Journal, stated that given the current situation in the U.S., and I quote her words, "It is likely that the documented 80% of low-income Americans without access to a lawyer has grown to an unthinkable 90%. Today, poor families in the wealthiest nation in the world, and moderate-income people as well, have a far better chance of winning the lottery than of finding the justice we promise our people. Congressional funding for legal services, corporation efforts for support of legal aid programs in the U.S. is woefully inadequate. It has been inadequate since the LSC was created in 1974, and it will always be inadequate given the political divide in Washington. Moreover, as has been pointed out, other sources of funding such as IOLTA program funding for civil legal aid has dramatically decreased due to declining interest rates and the economic downturn. And from my perspective, having traveled this country for the last 10 years, before and after and during I was ABA president, I think so highly of the lawyers in this country because there are tens of thousands of lawyers in this country who volunteer hundreds of thousands of legal aid services each year, barely make a dent in the 80% unmet legal needs gap. What has the ABA done to address the situation? In 2005, in my capacity as president of the ABA, I appointed a Blue Ribbon ABA Task Force on Access to Civil Justice to consider ways in which the 80% legal gap finally might be reduced. After a year of careful study, the task force proposed that the ABA adopt a resolution calling on all federal, state, and territorial governments to provide publicly funded counsel for eligible low-income individuals in certain, not all, civil adversarial proceedings, specifically those involving the five basic human needs of shelter, safety, health, sustenance, and child custody. In August of 2006, the ABA's policymaking body, the 565-member House of Delegates, without a single dissenting vote, adopted the task force's proposed resolution. In 2010, the ABA Working Group on a Civil Right to Counsel, which I'm honored to chair, proposed two additional policy resolutions that were adopted by the ABA House of Delegates. The policies provide two useful tools to assist those states that are interested in implementing the 2006 ABA policy. One is called the ABA Basic Principles in the Appointment of Counsel in Civil Legal Proceedings, and the other is an ABA Model Access Act, which states can use if they want to pursue a statutory approach.
I assume these are on your website still.
Yes, and I believe copies have been provided in paper.
Thank you.
And I should point out that the ABA working group at the moment is working on a third tool.
And this is a judge's manual, a judge's resource manual on the appointment of counsel in civil matters. At the moment, we have numerous law schools throughout the country helping the working group, the AB working group, on researching and documenting what authority exists in every state, whether it be by case decision, constitutional right, provisions, court rules, so that judges will know what authority they have, what is discretionary, what is mandatory. And that manual, we hope, will be finished in the next 8 or 9 months and be made available to all the courts in the United States. So I said that the rule proposed is cost-effective. What do I mean by that? Since adoption of the 2006 ABA policy, at least 15 states, in varying approaches, have been taking steps to do what this rule proposal requests. I have been asked to speak in many of those states, and I've done so. The major concerns I have heard expressed in those states, and I've heard them this morning by question of a couple of the justices, relate to cost and timing. What will it cost to recognize such a right? And where will the funds be found, especially in this economic recession? And isn't this a bad time to be considering such a right? Why not wait 5 years, 10 years, to consider the idea when resources are more plentiful? These are legitimate questions. There are legitimate answers to these questions. What will the cost be? A number of states, including Wisconsin, are now providing state-specific numbers to answer the cost question. Data from several state studies being conducted, for example, in California, you heard from Justice Johnson, what's happening there, Massachusetts, Texas, and Maryland, as well as recent actual cost and actual savings figures in a number of states demonstrate that providing counsel in all or any of the 5 basic human needs categories of legal aid actually reduces expenses for a state and produces substantial economic and societal benefits for the community, while also freeing up resources for court.
Greco, I read that. And my question was that I'm not quite clear exactly what is the Massachusetts rule about providing counsel to indigents.
At the moment, and for the last 15 or 20 years in Massachusetts, we have a form of the ABA policy. There are pockets of cases. Child custody is one of them. In certain instances, judges have the discretion to appoint counsel in landlord-tenant disputes, in domestic violence cases. But there is not yet in Massachusetts, as there might be, as I hope there will be in Wisconsin, a clear rule that informs the judges and counsel in the state that this is how we will make justice equal for all, that judges have this discretion. So while it's not uniform in Massachusetts, and I'm going to give you a couple of figures that demonstrate even without the rule, without a uniform rule, what's been happening in my state. You heard from Justice Johnson in California under the Sergeant Shriver Act, which was influenced, by the way, the adoption of that act was influenced by the ABA 2006 policy. $11 million per year is being allocated for 6 years to establish right to counsel pilot programs designed to, among other things, to measure the cost and savings of providing counsel in the 5 basic human needs areas defined in the ABA policy. These studies, taken all together, going on right now, are demonstrating that the consequential costs of not providing counsel for eligible indigent persons in those 5 human needs categories are costing a state as much as, and even more than, it would to provide counsel who can prevent the harm from occurring in the first place. Put differently, right now, Wisconsin
is paying tens of millions of dollars to remedy or rectify homelessness, denial of health benefits, child disputes. Those costs are ongoing right now. And Massachusetts and these other states have documented that that's what's happening. So in a sense, when we talk about cost, the cost is already there. The question is, do we want to spend money to prevent the suffering in the first instance by providing a lawyer, or are we going to spend it? We are spending it at the other end right now. And that analysis is so critically important to the cost question. For example, civil legal aid for eligible persons adds to a state's economy by bringing, among other things, federal funding into a state and helping people secure health benefits, employment, and child support. Among many documented examples in my September 9 letter are these. The Massachusetts Legal Assistance Corporation estimated that providing civil legal aid in fiscal year 2009 yielded $71 million in new revenues and cost savings for the state. In addition, legal aid in that year prevented or delayed homelessness for 1,851 households, which saved the state an additional $8 million in homeless shelter costs. In 2003, a report of the Minnesota State Bar documented that civil legal aid in that state assisted clients in obtaining more than $5 million annually in federal disability benefits. In Virginia, 2009, the Southwest Virginia Legal Aid Society reported that an expansion in legal aid to all low-income victims of domestic violence coincided with a 35% decrease in requests for and associated costs of domestic violence protective orders.
Mr. Greco, as you know, your time is up.
Even with the ceded time, have I already?
I hope that they gave you 10 minutes. I didn't check, and the marshal isn't here, so until
my understanding
she returns,
was that I'm sorry.
Well,
my understanding,
until she returns, you can talk, and then I'll check to make sure that she gave you.
My understanding was that I had about 16 minutes with the time allotted to me. But I'll
we're
be
not
shorter.
Going to debate it. Go
I'll
ahead.
I'll be shorter.
All right. Let me ask you, how much does Massachusetts spend on civil defense or civil litigation for expenses?
At the moment, we have different pockets of monies.
Okay,
we
so have it's state money.
We have state money that's in the budget.
Like some federal money.
It's not a lot of money. It's in the probably in the $10 to $11 million range. We have IOLTA funding. Mm-hmm. We have we have some monies, but again, Massachusetts, no state yet has a dedicated, significant budget line item mm-hmm. that of the type that we're talking about. So we heard a lot this morning about the burden on the courts of Wisconsin caused by the pro se litigants. And I don't want to belabor the point, but let me offer a couple of other statistics that may be helpful to the court. In 2010, the ABA Task Force on the Preservation of the Justice System examined the crisis resulting from chronic underfunding of the nation's courts, which is now exacerbated by the recession. The court underfunding crisis, combined with the justice gap, has caused a dramatic increase nationally in the number of low-income pro se litigants appearing before the courts, which in turn, as has been documented by a couple of the circuit court judges this morning, has led to unjust outcomes for these litigants. In the task force's 2011 report, 75% of the respondents stated that litigants who represent themselves in court are more likely to lose their cases. In a 2010 report of the ABA Coalition for Justice regarding its survey of judges, 62% of the judges responding said that the lack of representation has led to unjust outcomes that result from failure to present necessary evidence,
failure properly to object to evidence, ineffective witness examination, ineffective arguments, and procedural errors. And at a time when the courts are under intense pressure to become more efficient due to severe cutbacks, the increase in pro se litigation has caused greatly increased inefficiency. 78% of the judges surveyed said that the courts are negatively impacted by the parties who are not represented by counsel, and that those negative impacts include higher use of court staff time to assist pro se litigants and frequent interventions by judges to avoid injustice, which many believe compromises the impartiality of the court. By authorizing judges to appoint counsel for eligible indigent persons in certain limited civil matters, the proposed rule amendment will greatly decrease the number of pro se litigants in Wisconsin and help alleviate the problems just mentioned. Quickly, what about the bad timing question? Now,
We have a bad timing question here.
Let me get to the end then, because the point I wanted to make about the
timing.
I want
you to know that I'm more generous to out-of-staters than I am to homers, which is unlike the usual theory about state courts. But go ahead.
Beneficiary, Your Honor, thank
That's
you.
That's right.
I appreciate it.
I just wanted you to spell it out so it was recognized. Go ahead.
Let me just simply say on the timing, and I'll move on quickly. You heard Justice Johnson talk about what other countries are doing that shame the U.S., but that's not really the point. It is a point, but it's not the most important point. The important point on timing, in my view, is in the last 100 years, whereas all of the European nations that have adopted this rule, either by constitution, by case law, by court rule, indigents in those countries are getting justice. They're having a lawyer to assist them. What's been happening in the U.S. in the last 100 years? There has never been a time in this country in the last 100 years when we have felt that it was appropriate and necessary to fund legal services for the indigent. And I don't see that changing if we go another 10 years, another 15 years. Only when this court will speak will that change. Is this a bad time to amend Rule 1102? Providing counsel to indigent persons to protect basic human needs has never been more timely or necessary. The economic burdens on these individuals never more devastating. And for those who say, well, what's the harm in waiting 5 years? Give the court time to think about this. Well, what would happen if this court deferred or denied the petition? Harm would continue without relief for additional thousands of persons whose shelter will be lost without the aid of counsel, causing homelessness and great cost to them and to the state. For countless persons whose desperately needed and available, that's the irony, health benefits are available under Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and it's difficult for an uninitiated person to access those rights. Those will be lost because they lack assistance of counsel in accessing. For indigent parents facing loss of custody of a child because they lack counsel who competently are able to represent and present relevant evidence and law to the tribunal. And for those who are victimized daily by family violence, fear for their lives because they do not have access to a lawyer to help them. These are real harms, not speculative, not theoretical. They happen every day, and it's heartbreaking. And also real is, as you know better than anyone else, the burden on the courts in this state in dealing with pro se caseloads that assistance of counsel would greatly reduce. So my question is, why should the court defer action on petition 1008?
And your answer is they shouldn't.
You shouldn't.
Thank you, Mr. Greco.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity as an individual lawyer and as a spokesperson for the American Bar Association. And if the court were to adopt this rule, the ABA stands ready to assist the court in every way possible.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, let me say on behalf of the court, thank you to the American Bar Association for all it has done in this area and others relating to state courts. And I want to thank you personally for making the trip and for your excellent communication, both in writing and orally.
Thank you. We are all in this together, Your Honor, and that's why I'm here. And I think together we can find the solutions. We have to find these solutions. Thank you.
Thank you. The court will break for lunch. We will be back promptly at 1:30. We've only covered 9 speakers in 2.5 hours. So we have a long way to go, and the court has scheduled an open conference on this. So I'm going to be tougher and tighter on the time. So you've got an hour and a half to think through cutting your remarks, limiting them to, if not shorter than, not 8 minutes, but even shorter, and not repeating what others have said. So see you back at 1:30, and thank you all for coming.